It is current state here on WKAR at the top of the program. For more than 30 years, our first guest has sought to end suburban sprawl and urban disinvestment, both in American cities and around the world. Andres Duany is credited with advancing the design aesthetic known as New Urbanism. He's an architect and community planner whose firm, Duany Plater Zyberg, headquartered in Miami, has completed designs for almost 300 new towns, regional plans, and community vitalization projects. Officials and stakeholders in Michigan cities can hear Mr. Duany speak this Thursday in Detroit at the annual conference of the Michigan Municipal League. I spoke with Mr. Duany yesterday. He explained that new urbanism works differently from place to place.
You know, I believe you're from Lansing.
Correct.
And I've never been there, although I've been in Michigan. And I think that the answer about, you know, what new urbanism does is to contextualize the problem. Like, for example, if you are a relatively rural community, you know, that's the spirit of it, and the majority of the people prefer to live in houses, you know, because that's your culture, then what the new urbanism would say is go ahead, live in your houses, you know, have your cars, but also have, you know, mix up the incomes a bit, so that the people who mow the lawn and the people who run the companies, you know, basically people who need each other, are not too far, and try to get your ordinary daily needs within walking distance. You know, if you could get some groceries so that people could age in place, or that something like 50% of Americans don't drive because they're too young or too old or too poor, they should have a right to walk to their ordinary daily needs, you know, to have them within walking distance.
Okay.
And that's all the new urbanism would do. Now, if you're in a place like California that is absolutely choked in traffic, right, already,
mm-hmm.
terrible, then you would say, or they're in a bowl like Utah, you know, where the automobile pollution is terrible. It's causing a kind of overcast, permanent overcast. Then you say, okay, I think you have to ratchet this up, and everything possible should be done so that public transit will work. You know, so that people can take buses and trains and so forth. And that would require a density of something like 14 units to the acre to support it, because that's what that's about, you know. So I think new urbanism, the thing to remember is that while there are some hard and fast rules, they're always adjusted to local circumstance. You know, because in the end, what we're in it for is human happiness. You know, this is not a movement that's primarily environmental. It's not a movement that's primarily about, you know, making developers money. It's a movement about saying, how can we increase the sum of human happiness by actually fitting people to their environment better than suburban sprawl does, giving them more choice.
Now, your presentation at the Michigan Municipal League gathering on Thursday is actually about what's labeled lean urbanism. How does new urbanism and lean urbanism differ?
Well, new urbanism, which began in 1980, has been through different phases as it became mature, as it grew. And its current manifestation, the so-called next gen of new urbanists, are very local in their attitude. You know, they're part of the millennials is that they work locally. And many of them are not interested in engaging policy decisions and so forth. They just want to sort of make their communities better. And so lean urbanism is a way of saying, let's lighten up on the red tape. Let's lighten up on how long it takes to do things to enable the young generation to act. You know, just like when we were 30 years old and bureaucracy was so much lighter than it is now, we got some pretty great things done. So what we're trying to get at here is whatever is impeding smaller and more local and essentially younger people from acting, that we need to clear that out, because there are 80 million millennials and we can't wait for them to become experts in what, you know, in the national bureaucratic mess that we have. I'm not talking about politics. This isn't right-left, okay? This isn't about the politics, which is another kind of mess. This is pure bureaucracy. This is the stuff that survives whether you get a Republican president or a Democratic president.
Right.
what it does is it delivers the entire system to big professional expert firms and to lawyers. And the young people are totally turned off by this.
What principles of lean urbanism or new urbanism can be applied to a situation or to a landscape as dire as Detroit's or Flint's?
Well, actually,
are your ideas better suited for smaller communities?
No. In fact, it's so funny that, of course, the whole world is talking about Detroit. But think about why the young people are flocking to Detroit. And they're renovating houses, and they're moving into places, and they're starting businesses, and they're starting farms. You know why they're going to Detroit? Because the bureaucracy has fallen apart, so they can act. Detroit is front and center example of lean urbanism. You see, it's the kids who are going to Detroit from all over America are going there because they can't get anything done back in their communities because they're being choked by bureaucracy. So Detroit is the test case for lean urbanism. And we are going to have a conference in Detroit in about 3 weeks, the so-called lean urbanists, not to teach Detroit anything, but to learn from Detroit, to meet some of these people who in their 20s and 30s are doing amazing things.
You're saying that Detroit went from a code red situation to a code pink situation just out of necessity because of its awful circumstances.
Actually, that's a very good, I might quote you. Code red and code pink. Perfect.
Our city's challenge, Lansing's challenge for many years, was the downtown became a ghost town in the evening. And I'm sure you've encountered this many times over the years. The situation's definitely improved significantly. We've attracted big businesses, and we've redeveloped our downtown riverfront. And there's a minor league baseball stadium downtown that brings people downtown. What do cities in that situation, what can they do to keep evolving?
Well, okay, I bet that virtually everything you did was what I call in the tail end of the 20th century. You know, and by the way, the 20th century ended in 2008. It didn't enter and end in the 00 period, you know. Centuries don't end at 00, you know. For example, the 19th century ended in 1914, you know, the First World War, right? And what happened was that the first 7 years of the 20th century, of the 21st century, were really the tail end of the 20th. And we were an incredibly rich country. Now, a lot of the wealth was artificial, but it was there. And we were able to do things like public-private partnerships. So when you look at everything that you did in those years, you know, and you mentioned the baseball field, you mentioned the big corporations, they were all either public-private partnerships, which essentially are subsidized, or they were straight subsidized, right? Which is to say that there was a lot of public money. Well, now there isn't any public money. We're back to a totally new condition, which I call the reality of the 21st century. You know, it began in 2008. So you can't do it that way anymore. And lean urbanism is a direct response to this problem. It's a response that says, okay, there's no public money for subsidy, but there's all this energy, this young energy, the energy of the unemployed, who are not basically, you know, developers, the energy of the young who, you know, don't know how to deal with bureaucracy. And by the way, don't forget the immigrants. The immigrants have an incredible energy. They have a lot more energy than just picking fruit and being janitors. Okay, these are people who come from countries that always built for themselves. If you give them a chance between the immigrants, the young people, and basically the unemployed, they can all work for themselves if they're not choked by what has become the American bureaucratic monster.
We're talking with Andres Duane, who is in Detroit here on Thursday at the annual convention of the Michigan Municipal League to talk about lean urbanism. You've become something of a prognosticator of what America might be like in the future. Can you give us a couple of your more daring predictions for American cities in the next 20 to 30 years?
You know, I'm an architect, and I used to actually have to think ahead about 5 years, you know, because between the time you're commissioned for the building and the time it's occupied and so forth, it's, you know, 3 to 5 years. And when I started being an urbanist and I realized that our first projects were being completed 30 years later, okay, you know, that's when they're running all. So even if you start right now, they run on all cylinders, you know, a generation later. So it gradually become accustomed to looking at a 15-year-old and saying, aha, that kid's going to be 45 years old, right? And you begin looking to the future almost obsessively. Like the present is a distortion field. So when you ask, what are the prognostications for the future? What I know about this country is that it was able to house 30 to 40 million immigrants without a penny in the latter half of the 19th century. Basically, they didn't have a banking system, and yet they built tremendous wealth through what essentially was management expertise and government with a very light hand. You know, they laid out, I mean, just take the Mormons. The Mormons, in 50 years, laid out about 530 new towns and cities in 50 years, and not one of them failed. And by the way, some of them are quite large, like San Diego. I mean, that's a Mormon outfit. Las Vegas is another. So you look at these people and you say, Americans can be very, very organized and create wealth out of nothing if you kind of leave them alone, if you don't distort it. So I must say, I've become a kind of libertarian, you know, not a right-wing sort, but simply I'd say, I think you need to trust people to do more for themselves. Because I think wealth has evaporated. You know, the wealth that we built over the last 300 years, we have actually shoved at the oil-producing countries. You know, if you go to Emirates, or you go to Dubai or whatever, or you go to Saudi, they're building fantastic everything. Like, they have airlines of hundreds of brand-new airplanes, and they have incredible airports and incredible transit systems and all the high-rises. And you look at that and you say, hey, that's American wealth. We've taken the wealth we've built in the last couple of hundred years patiently, and shoved it essentially at the Arab countries. We've shoveled it out. So now we're poor. And I think what Detroit and Pontiac and all these other cities have to confront is that there's no money to throw around. And that's a permanent condition. It isn't the real estate bubble that's going to go away. You know, we're going to recover from the real estate bubble. But what it revealed was an underlying impoverishment that means we have to be a lot smarter with our money. That's the number one prediction. I don't permit myself to have ideas anymore that cost money. You know, they have to pay for themselves. Not interested in, you know, in anybody subsidizing anything, because it ain't going to be done. That's 20th century thinking. The second thing I think we should know, if you believe in climate change, and I do, there's no evidence we're going to beat it. You know, there's all the indicators are going wrong. There's a new report coming out, you know, probably this week. The indicators are all taking a dive. You know, everything is worse. There's more carbon everywhere. And if you've been to China, and if you've been to India, and even if you've been to Italy, you realize, or Russia, they have no intention whatsoever of complying with Kyoto as a people. The government can sign anything they want, you know, in terms of a treaty. But the people aren't going to do a damn thing. I mean, they're growing at 20, 30 million a year just to begin with. You know, and each human is a disaster, you know. So one of the things I'm looking at is, if climate change cannot be stopped, even if the worst parts are put off 100 years, it's going to be a very depressing circumstance psychologically. There's going to be a whole new take on the future, on the world, on the value of doing things, on the value of just having fun, on the value of, let's say, looking at the place becoming much less secure, you know, in terms of crime. You know, people get poor, people begin robbing each other. And so I'm beginning to think about a great demoralization, you know, in which you say, wow, it's curtains for Western culture, not the human race, but Western culture. It's curtains. How are we going to deal with it? And one of the things that I think raises your spirit is, instead of mitigation, which requires a worldwide investment, you know, everybody acting together, you can do adaptation. Adaptation is what you can do locally. You can prepare your local community for what's coming. You can bring agriculture nearby so that, you know, when the strawberries don't fly in from Chile anymore, you have strawberries. You can actually have power generation, which you might be solar. Now, don't do solar because it's good for carbon. Do solar, you know, on your house, because if there's a brownout, you know, if the big grid collapses, you can still keep operating. you keep people doing the right thing. You know, you keep people bringing agriculture nearby. You keep people concerned about renewables and so forth. But the explanation isn't we're going to fix the world's climate. It's not that, because I think, as I said, as the news gets worse and worse, we're not going to believe in it anymore. And to avoid a great moral collapse, you need to say, yes, but you can work locally.
Very interesting.
Do you see what I'm saying?
I do.
Now, this happens to be doing the right thing. It happens to be almost exactly the same checklist, doing the right thing, but you present it differently. We're circling the wagons. It's myself and my community, and the hell with the Chinese, and the hell with the Indians, and the hell with the Arabs. You know, they can do their own stuff. I'm taking care of my community because actually what I do matters.
Andres Duany is the founder and partner in the architectural firm Duany Plater Zyberg. He's a longtime proponent of new urbanism, and you can hear Mr. Duany speak Thursday in Detroit at the annual conference of the Michigan Municipal League.